made during concerts. Those articles weren't ever written. Why not? Because this is a transparent example of a journalist who doesn't agree with the selection of Kid Rock using his, quote, objective journalism to discredit the selection while attempting to cover this as an actual news story. Here's the paragraph from the ESPN homepage story that seeks to justify the story's very existence as a legitimate piece of news. The NHL's decision to have him perform at the All-Star Game was widely criticized on social media this week. It's the second time in recent months that a Kid Rock appearance created controversy in the hockey world, as the Detroit Red Wings were criticized for having him open their new arena with a concert in August 2017. Again, social media criticism isn't a legitimate hook for news stories, nor is citing social media criticism as a controversy or a backlash. Literally everything is criticized all day long on social media. By this logic, there is a perpetual backlash to everything. If this writer wanted to write an opinion piece that Kid Rock was the wrong choice for the NHL because of his political opinions, have at it. Fire away with that opinion. I may not agree with the opinion, but at least it's clearly an opinion, not an opinion being disguised as news by hiding in the skirts of anonymous social media backlash. This article is an illegitimate left-wing opinion piece disguised as sports news, and here's the even wilder thing. Editors at ESPN read this article and elected to promote it as one of the top stories in all of sports. Why? Because those editors at ESPN agree that Kid Rock's political opinions are unacceptable, and they, just like the writer, want to broadcast that opinion, which has been disguised as news, to as wide an audience as is possible. Now, I just happened to dissect this story about Kid Rock, but after taking the red pill, I saw stories like this everywhere. The biased sports media was picking sides. They weren't even picking sides fairly. They were disguising opinion-based journalism as real news. None of these examples we've discussed here are actual sports stories. They reflect what has become all too commonplace. There were now acceptable and unacceptable opinions. I could find countless other examples where if you strayed outside the left-wing talking points, you were assaulted by the sports media zealots until you apologized or dialed back your commentary. Sometimes the left-wing sports media came after you even if you'd done absolutely nothing wrong at all. In January 2017, ESPN analyst Doug Adler was calling one of Venus Williams' Australian Open tennis matches for ESPN's online viewers. During the match, as Williams charged the net, Adler used the phrase "gorilla effect" to describe Venus charging the net to win a point. The comment would have likely gone unnoticed, but for someone clipping the comment off the website and sharing it on social media. Shortly thereafter, a left-wing tennis reporter for the New York Times shared the clip on Twitter, writing, "This is some appalling stuff. Horrifying that the Williams sisters remain subjected to it still in 2017. Except, you know, the phrase gorilla tennis has been used for decades and was the tagline for a popular tennis commercial featuring Andre Agassi and Pete Sampras, in which the duo played tennis on a New York street. Plus, if you used your brain at all, was this really the actions of a racist? Had Adler been practicing sleeper cell racism, pretending not to be racist while calling over a decade's worth of tennis matches so he could one day call Venus Williams a gorilla, G-O-R-I-L-L-A, on an online broadcast of a second-round Australian Open match whose viewership likely measured in the hundreds? If anything, Adler's word choice is far from racist, since if he were racist and thought Williams resembled a gorilla, he probably wouldn't use the phrase gorilla effect, G-U-E-R-R-I-L-L-A, because he'd be afraid of being discovered to be racist. By the way, when is the last time someone described an animal by appending the word effect after it? If you described someone as behaving like an alligator, you wouldn't say they were slinking underwater like an alligator effect. You'd say they were slinking underwater like an alligator. That didn't matter for the sports media and the mob online. Adler was publicly branded a racist, Worse, the stink of publicly being branded a racist scared others from coming forward to defend him. Rather than defend him against the left-wing sports media mob, ESPN fired Adler after demanding that he apologize for his word choice. Adler would come on my morning radio show and share his story. Friends of his at ESPN suggested he reach out to me because I was the only person in sports media they believed wouldn't be afraid to have him on air. It wasn't that anyone believed Adler was racist. It was that many were so afraid of becoming targets of the online left-wing mob themselves that they didn't even want to be connected to him and end up being publicly branded as racist as well. Adler has now been out of work for nearly 2 years and has a lawsuit pending against ESPN. It is, he told me, the worst thing that has ever happened to me in my life. Adler was so crushed by the left-wing mob that tore him apart online and by ESPN's refusal to defend him despite decades of evidence that he wasn't racist that he couldn't sleep for months. The stress over being publicly branded a racist and losing his job, according to his doctors, caused him to have a heart attack. Adler nearly died despite doing nothing wrong. Worst of all, the truth didn't matter. Adler was gone, the victim of a word that sounded like another word, a homophonic racist. As if that weren't enough, in the spring of 2018, another Disney employee, Steve Harvey, went on ESPN SportsCenter before Game 3 of the NBA Finals between the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Golden State Warriors and called the entire Golden State Warriors team gorillas, G-O-R-I-L-L-A-S. You can't stop all them boys, Harvey said live on ESPN. They've got too many gorillas on the team. They come into play, man. They got 800-pound gorillas on they team. Disney, the parent company of ESPN, which fired Adler for using the phrase gorilla effect during a Venus Williams match and employed Harvey via the Family Feud TV show he hosts, did nothing at all to Harvey for actually calling the entire Golden State Warriors team, made up of almost all African-American players, gorillas. The social media outrage from the sports media, non-existent. Thank God for double standards, because without them, Disney and ESPN would have no standards at all. But isn't this where an unbiased sports media should stand up and defend Adler? Other than me, there was not one single prominent member of the sports media who took note of the double standard. All the biased, far left-wing sports media coverage happened in the wake of the Michael Sam story, which is, I believe, when ESPN's turn to the far left, which would be copied by the rest of the sports media, really happened. Back on that draft day in 2014, Michael Sam had become the 249th player selected in the NFL draft, but he nearly received more media attention than all the other draftees combined in the days ahead. For the next several months, ESPN obsessively covered Sam's every move. Never before had a seventh-round draft choice received this much attention. Many sports commentators even compared him to Jackie Robinson. Except, you know, everyone could see that Jackie Robinson was black, and no one would have known who Michael Sam slept with if he hadn't told us. But beware, if you argued anything other than that Sam was the most important sports figure since Jackie Robinson, you were a homophobe. For the first time, sports fans began to email and tweet me about ESPN's round-the-clock coverage. Why, one emailer asked me, is Michael Sam being covered like he's Tom Brady? While the network had fallen victim to celebrities before, as Tim Tebow, Johnny Manziel, and LeBron James could attest, the celebrities ESPN previously obsessed over were typically top athletes. Never before had a practice squad player received his own reporting team. It was a harbinger of things to come. The first time ESPN allowed a non-star to dominate its sports coverage, and not just a non-star, but one that fit into ESPN's liberal agenda. Goodbye, ESPN. Hello, MS ESPN. However, if you thought the Michael Sam coverage was excessively left-wing, you hadn't seen anything yet. Up next was Caitlyn Jenner. For many, both inside and outside ESPN, the decision to award Caitlyn Jenner an ESPY for bravery and courage was the moment when the network stopped covering sports and officially became a left-wing ideological and political channel. By the summer of 2015, ESPN had lost 8 million subscribers and its ratings were tanking for all non-live event programming. The network needed something to galvanize attention and bring in viewers. Luckily, there was a deal to be made. Caitlyn Jenner, born Bruce Jenner, was going to announce her transition to womanhood on Diane Sawyer's ABC program. Why not couple that decision with giving Jenner the 2015 ESPY for Courage? The ESPYs begun in 1993 were ESPN's answer to the Oscars, a large gathering of sports celebrities where the network presented awards for the year's best achievements in sports. In 2015, the top award, named after tennis great Arthur Ashe, went to Jenner for having the courage to embrace a truth that had been hidden for years and to embark on a journey that may not only give comfort to those facing similar circumstances, but can also help to educate people on the challenges that the transgender community faces, according to a top ESPN executive. Anyone in the sports media who questioned the award was publicly shamed online. The decision, to me, was nakedly political and partisan, a clear decision by ESPN to wed sports and left-wing politics. Look, I'm all for people making decisions that make them happier. But what made Caitlyn Jenner a hero? Deciding to put on a dress and become a woman made you heroic? What kind of world was ESPN living in to believe that sports fans shared this opinion? Did Tom Hanks and Robin Williams deserve the Congressional Medal of Honor for pretending to be women on television? Hell, could you even make the movie Mrs. Doubtfire today? What in the world, my audience wanted to know, was happening in the sports world? Why was ESPN trying to socially engineer sports to its own political persuasion? Jenner, who last participated in athletics in the 1980s, also allowed ESPN to dodge the truly difficult issues with her honoring. What would the reaction have been if Jenner were a present-day athlete? A dominant gold medal winner who suddenly decided to become a woman at the peak of her athletic ability. Would she have deserved to compete as a woman? I suspect most of you would have an issue with that. Certainly the Olympics would as well. However, if we aren't going to have men and women compete against each other in the Olympics, allowing someone to choose their gender violates the spirit of competition. After all, no women would likely ever win a medal if men decided to identify as women for their competitions. Honoring Jenner long after her career ended allowed ESPN to avoid these potential pitfalls. ESPN never addressed any of these challenges of the gender fluid lifestyle. As is, Jenner accepted the award on ABC. It was the first time the ESPYs had ever aired on ABC instead of ESPN, in front of a massive television audience, the biggest to ever watch the ESPYs. As Jenner addressed the huge audience with the Kardashian family beaming from the front row, ESPN executives rejoiced. This was the exact kind of political statement they believed the network needed to maintain its cultural relevance. Hosannas poured in from the left-wing sports media, praising ESPN for its brave programming decision. But all was not well. What, many asked, did Jenner have to do with sports at all? Jenner hadn't been active in sports for over 30 years. Why was ESPN needlessly interjecting itself into America's culture wars with a person who wasn't a sports figure at all? The answer was all too simple. For ratings, ESPN had become MS-ESPN, and the rest of sports media was following ESPN right over the political cliff. Chapter 4. The Social Media Trap. I began this book telling you that in September of 2017, I almost got fired from my radio show for saying I like the First Amendment and boobs live on CNN. As we begin this discussion of social media's impact on sports, my own experience in the center of a social media hurricane is a perfect one to take you inside how stories like this play out. In the immediate aftermath of my appearance on CNN, my phone exploded. As I told you, one of those texts came from my wife downstairs in our house. She was terrified of what the outcome was going to be. I wasn't. Because the truth of the matter is this, I love being in the center of a media hurricane. I find it energizing, invigorating, and the modern day equivalent of playing three-dimensional chess. While other people are losing their heads, I'm coolly analyzing the situation and making the smartest moves to maximize my advantage. I hadn't misspoken. I'd been saying I loved the First Amendment and boobs for a couple of years. I'd even said it the day before on CNN's headline news with another female anchor at CNN. She laughed off the line as Brooke Baldwin would have as well if she'd had an ounce of honesty. Instead of blowing up the interview and adopting a posture of false outrage, she should have addressed the substance of my argument, not the rhetorical flair. And by the way, how could CNN claim to be astonished I used the line when I'd used the line on their own airwaves the previous day? Regardless, as a media hurricane enveloped me, I stayed calm. Public relations executives told me to stay quiet, but I did the exact opposite. I understand modern media better than most PR executives do. PR executives always recommend giving into the mob and apologizing, which is like trying to get rid of sharks by throwing them more chum. Rather than stay quiet, I immediately did a live Periscope and Facebook show to tell my side of the story. As part of that story, I announced we would be selling First Amendment and Boobs t-shirts at OutKick, and that we'd be donating the proceeds to breast cancer awareness. A few minutes after my show, my phone rang. It was CNN leaving a voicemail message inviting me back on the air on Monday. This was pure gold. I tweeted out this invitation from CNN, creating a new uproar. How could CNN claim to be upset if they had already invited me back on the network? CNN executives, evidently unaware of the fact that a producer from one of their shows had invited me back on the airwaves, issued a false denial of my invitation. I took to Periscope to play the live voicemail of my CNN invitation back on their airwaves. Later on Friday night, the same CNN producer texted me to cancel the interview, so I screenshotted her text message to me and shared it with my entire audience. What was fascinating about the CNN interview offer was that the mainstream media who'd reported that my invitation on CNN was false never issued any correction of their falsehood. The more time I spent as a member of the news media, the more often I noticed something alarming. The media got an awful lot of facts wrong. While I was out there fighting a war to protect my side of the story, PR people were checking social media and they were afraid that some people online were reacting negatively to my statements on CNN. So what if there was an even bigger collection of people, many of whom are reading this book right now, that loved what I'd said on CNN and the fact that I wasn't backing down and issuing a false apology to try to sate the mob? That didn't matter. There were people upset online and they were demanding blood. They wanted me fired for saying I liked the First Amendment and boobs, and some people in positions of power were endorsing the decision. It looked like they might be winning. Within 3 hours of my statements on CNN, my name and bio had been pulled off the Fox Sports Radio website. When a tipster sent me the link to the website, I could only laugh. The irony of a First Amendment absolutist losing a job because of fear related to a social media campaign being led by crackpots was positively delectable. As the day progressed, it looked like I might be fired from my radio show, yet another victim of the far left-wing social media mob. However, I'm a fighter, and while others would have apologized and begged for forgiveness, I doubled down on my response with my job on the line. Why should I apologize for saying something I believed? Especially when, as was the case here, the response from CNN and the other guest on the show was clearly rooted in faux rage, aka false social media outrage. As the story grew, the CNN host Brooke Baldwin took to the CNN website to write a histrionic piece about our interview. Included in her article were these phrases. I've been a journalist for 17 years, the past 7 spent at CNN hosting a live show. I've seen and heard some things, but when I first heard boobs from a grown man on national television in 2017, my initial thought bubble was, did I hear that correctly? There's no way he just came on my show and said what I think he said. Did he? And I let it hang. The thing is, this is not okay. Speaking to women like this is unacceptable. It is 2017. Why is this even happening? That was the crux of her argument, that I should speak differently to her than I should a male anchor. Isn't that the very definition of sexism? The idea that my speech should be altered based on the sex of the person I'm speaking to? Shouldn't I do what I always do, speak the exact same way to men and women in public settings? This became even more ridiculous when Brooke Baldwin had the lawyer for Stormy Daniels, the porn star who alleged she had a sexual relationship with Donald Trump, on dozens of times and quizzed him in graphic detail about the alleged sexual encounter. I mean, come on. Could you really claim to be offended by my statement when you were dissecting the president's sexual encounter with a porn star like it was a Super Bowl winning play? Even wilder, CNN devoted hours and hours of coverage to Hugh Hefner's death. If anyone believed in the First Amendment and boobs more than me, it was Hefner, whom CNN praised as a true American hero. CNN and its hosts weren't actually outraged. They were pretending to be outraged to garner social media attention. This was also true of the other guest, Keith Reed, a former ESPN editor. Reed expressed outrage at my statements as well, but within a few hours, my social media defenders had combed through Brooke Baldwin and Reed's past online history to determine that both were full of crap. It turns out Reed, who was offended by my saying I liked boobs, had a Twitter feed full of graphic endorsements of women's asses and boobs. I mean, you can't even make this stuff up. The guy pretended to be outraged by my liking boobs while he'd been tweeting how much he liked asses for years. Maybe after all, he was offended that I was more of a boob man than an ass man. Meanwhile, Baldwin had laughed when her CNN co-host Don Lemon told Kathy Griffin live on air that she had a great rack and discussed his nipples. On New Year's Eve of 2017, Baldwin told Don Lemon she had bigger balls than he did live on CNN. OutKick would later get its revenge on New Year's Eve of that same year when two of our fans staged a fake marriage proposal in a New Orleans bar and then sprang up, grabbed a microphone, and the woman screamed in Baldwin's face that they loved boobs, B-O-O-B-S, spelling it out on air just as she had. It turned out that Baldwin herself had said far worse than I had on CNN's own airwaves. Even still, as the day progressed, the odds of me being fired vacillated. I continued to fight the battle, insisting that I'd done nothing at all wrong. Eventually, I got on the phone with top executives and made my case that if they fired me for saying I loved the First Amendment and boobs, the backlash from that decision was going to be far worse and make this story far bigger than it already was. For several hours, my radio show hung in the balance. Would I be fired or not? My phone continued to buzz incessantly until it turned hot to the touch, like it had been sitting outside in the sun all day. Slowly, as the afternoon hours moved into evening, I began to win the argument. Reasonable minds became aware that firing me for saying I loved the First Amendment and boobs would make me a free speech martyr. Public opinion, now divided, would move back squarely on my side. By late that night, my position on the Fox Sports Radio webpage was restored. My bosses at Fox Sports Radio, including Don Martin, Scott Shapiro, and Julie Talbot, had lined up squarely behind me. So did the head of Fox Sports, Eric Shanks. For all of their support in the midst of the media maelstrom, I was and remain grateful. Fox Sports, which was being pressured to condemn me, released a tepid statement on Friday night that quickly vanished into the oncoming weekend of new football games. That statement read as follows. In response to Clay Travis's appearance on CNN today, his comments were inappropriate. Clay Travis has not worked at Fox Sports for 6 months and is a syndicated talent of Premier Networks. For their part, Premier Networks, who had stood behind me steadfastly throughout the day, released a statement saying I'd be on the show Monday and would face no punishment. Until this book was released, very few people knew how close I came to being fired from my radio show for what I said on CNN. I like to think I won an important battle against the far left-wing social media proponents of faux rage that the First Amendment and boobs were still okay for an American white male to publicly admit that he liked. All of you can breathe a sigh of relief. After a day-long battle to keep my radio show, I wasn't going to be fired for what I'd said on CNN. I was, however, banned forever from appearing on CNN, adding my prior banning from ESPN to the hit list, which meant I'd now become the only media person in America who was banned from appearing on both CNN and ESPN. Plus, when you really get down to it, why was I banned by CNN and ESPN? Because I said and wrote things that upset the liberal orthodoxy, because the things you've read in this book aren't commonly said, because the First Amendment only matters to CNN and ESPN if you're saying what they want to hear. Even if many in the liberal and far left-wing media claim that they embrace diversity of thought and opinion, the fact that I'm banned for my opinions on those two television networks tells you everything you need to know about our modern era. As my radio job hung in the balance, I stepped back and considered the larger picture of the modern-day social media era. What I'd done was feed the beast, provided a video to allow another battle in the ongoing culture war to be fought. Before long, what I'd said didn't matter because I'd become a signpost in our modern culture war. People today fight not over specific facts or incidences, but over whether those facts and incidences confirm or conflict with their existing worldview. Social media is just one large blame factory, a race to determine who is right and who is wrong. I was in the center of that blame factory, either a hero or a villain, depending on what you already believed. What I'd said and who I was didn't matter. I was just another battleground, a proxy to allow the never-ending fight to continue. The most ironic angle to me of the entire imbroglio was that many on the left wing asserted that the reason I'd said what I said was because Donald Trump had been elected president. That Trump's election had somehow emboldened me to suddenly like boobs. Did they really believe that if Hillary Clinton had been elected, I would have stopped liking boobs? Hell, I worked on Al Gore's presidential campaign in 2000, and let me go on the record right now and make it clear. I liked boobs then too. Furthermore, the entire premise of the outrage industry was entirely artificial. Were any women really surprised that men liked boobs? Victoria's Secret has turned the bra into its own version of the Manhattan Project, extracting billions of dollars out of making women's boobs look bigger and better than they did in other bras. Every year, billions of dollars, billions with a B, are spent on boob jobs in this country. Yet me joking about the First Amendment and boobs was a sudden cultural battleground? Come on. It was all far left wingers grabbing their pearls like Brooke Baldwin and pretending to be outraged when they knew what I said wasn't outrageous at all. As I was in the tempest, I was cognizant of the fact that my own social media fracas tied in with the larger social media explosion that has changed sports media substantially in the past several years. Indeed, one of my theories, which I established in the prior chapter, is that ESPN's desperation over its collapsing business model pushed it to left-wing politics to retain relevance as its revenue and ratings collapsed. It's also important to note that it wasn't just ESPN moving left in the sports media. CBS, NBC, and Fox Sports were all doing the same thing. While I believe ESPN led the charge, FS1, CBS, and NBC have also all promoted sports figures embracing left-wing politics and mixing it with sports. By the fall of 2017, even though I'm relatively middle of the road in my political leanings compared to everyone else in sports media, I appeared far right. That's not because I'm a far right winger, a term regularly applied to anyone who thinks socialism is a bad idea. It's because the sports media has become so far left wing that someone in the middle, even someone like me who leans a little bit left of middle on social issues and a bit right on fiscal issues, seems like a far right winger. When I went to the wedding of a law school classmate in the fall of 2017, I asked several friends there whether sports had gone insane politically or I had. Every single guy and girl attending the wedding whom I'd gone to law school with, you get to know everyone's politics pretty well in law school, said what I wrote and said in 2018 sounded the exact same as what I wrote and said back in law school in 2004. Only back then I was a Democrat, and now I call myself a radical moderate. I haven't changed at all. Social media has just caused everyone else to go insane, and here I am, the most reasonable person in sports, who also happens to have the best hair. Why did this happen? I think ESPN and the sports media that followed ESPN's lead started paying way too much attention to social media. The most active Twitter users skewed left, but they weren't ESPN's target audience. Heck, most of the people weren't even sports fans. But they were loud, and they seemed very powerful online. Effectively, ESPN stopped serving the average sports fan and began to cater to the sports fan on social media. Out was ESPN's target audience of a guy who wanted to drink a beer and catch up on sports news. In was the social justice warrior who wanted to complain about white privilege and systemic racism online, all while not actually watching sports on television. The most absurd thing about far left-wing social justice warriors interjecting politics into sports is that most of them aren't actually sports fans. Go look at video from a Colin Kaepernick rally sometime. Those are not the people spending all day Sunday watching football. They just want to be mad about something online. Of course, social media was just part of the rapidly evolving media environment everyone, myself included, faced in the modern era. What's also fascinating about our modern era is how similar it is to the media eras we would have seen hundreds of years ago, particularly in the days long before radio and TV and the internet popularized viral stories on social media. Let's pause here for a moment, and let me take you way back in time, to the earliest days of America as a country, when the mass distribution of ideas was still in its infancy, because I think modern-day social media is very similar to what early American media was like. As Rustin Cole on HBO's True Detective memorably intoned, time is a flat circle. For most of American media history, there was no concept of unbiased, neutral journalism. Newspapers endorsed political candidates and savaged their opponents in print. If you think politics is rough now, go read what was written about Andrew Jackson's wife when he ran for president in 1828, or what was said about Abraham Lincoln during his 1860 and 1864 presidential campaigns. Newspapers, which in their most basic business models are a method to deliver advertisements to readers, were the first mass-distributed method of political discourse in this country. Leaving aside pamphlets like Thomas Paine's Common Sense, newspapers were our first mass-distributed pop culture. Newspapers didn't begin as impartial and unbiased recitations of the day's news. They began as ribald, rollicking, bitterly partisan broadsides for or against particular political candidates, parties, and policies. It wasn't until near the beginning of the 20th century that any notion of unbiased news took root in the popular conception. What did unbiased news offer from a business perspective? Something for everyone. Instead of only selling newspapers to Republicans or Democrats or Whigs or Tories, you could appeal to every single person and an entire community. The notion of unbiased news wasn't a creation demanded by journalistic ethics to ensure an educated American populace. It was a newspaper business model that led to bigger audiences and bigger profits. That unbiased newspaper business model carried through into the 20th century with the two major media innovations adopted by households: radio and television, that were designed to appeal to the largest possible audiences as well. Due to the fact that they were public licenses, TV and radio were required to give equal weight to both political parties. Radio and television shows were created with mass appeal prioritized over individual appeal. I Love Lucy and the Andy Griffith Show gave way to MASH and the Cosby Show, but the goal remained the same: creating a type of entertainment that appealed to everyone from 8 to 80. The 20th century was the golden age of pop culture centrism. You didn't get exactly what you loved the most, but you got what everyone could love at least a little bit. Grandma and grandson were both entertained. This shouldn't be shocking, but it may strike you as such given the modern media environment. In order to appeal to everyone, you have to be pretty moderate and reasonable, which meant that by and large, the story of the 20th century in America was the triumph of reasonableness. Now let's pause for a moment and think about how astoundingly different the rise of modern American pop culture was. Think about what the average American's life would have been like in 1900 compared to 1965. In 1900, what pop culture was there? If you traveled to California and you were from New York, something that relatively few people would have even done, what shared interests might you have to discuss with someone from the opposite coasts? Food, relationships, children, travel, horses, maybe politics if you read a regular newspaper, which most didn't. But there would have been no shared national discourse in 1900 on television or movies or sports or music. If you were well-read, maybe you could talk about a popular book, but odds are that other than reading the Bible in church or Shakespeare in school, you wouldn't have read that much in common either. That experience in 1900 wasn't that much different from what might have happened throughout human history. Up until the advent of the printing press, the only way people could easily share stories was orally. These stories, think the Iliad or Epic of Gilgamesh, two epic poems you may have claimed to have read in high school or college, were rare and didn't translate across all cultures. Even with the advent of the printing press, literacy was incredibly rare for most of human history. So for most of human history, popular culture didn't exist. When it did exist, religion was pretty much the only popular culture. Yet by 1965, just 65 years later, virtually every kid in America had been exposed to I Love Lucy and Bonanza. Sports, now integrated and open to everyone, thrived as the national embodiment of our culture. It was the story that united us across our divisions. With the rise of modern technology, sports became a national, not just a regional story. Suddenly, with the advent of the radio and later television, the most remote holler in West Virginia could be as aware of what was going on in the country as the most urbane New Yorker. Significantly, the entertainment that both consumed would have been very similar too. With a relative paucity of entertainment options available, everyone watched or listened to the same things. Our national discourse became united around first the radio and then the television dial. As a result, all our media was designed to appeal to the largest possible audiences. And the same became true of our sports. Cable started to change that in the 1980s and early 90s, but most of the early popular cable channels weren't in the business of creating original content. They just took older popular content and re-aired it. If you're around my age, you could come home and watch TBS After School, but TBS After School was repurposed original pop culture for mass audiences from earlier decades. You could watch The Brady Bunch, or The Jetsons, or The Beverly Hillbillies, or some other popular show that used to air on broadcast television for massive audiences of older generations. Most of cable in its early years wasn't about giving us anything new. It was just about giving us older shows in a new format. All of this conspired to mean that the 20th century, in retrospect, was about making us all very similar in our interests. More so than any other century, it ended our national balkanization. Television, radio, and newspapers were about connecting massive audiences with shared experiences via limited but insanely popular viewing and reading options. When the radio or television came on in the 20th century, the entire family listened or watched together. That media environment created a national discourse that even when surrounded by incredibly complex and difficult national issues, Vietnam, the civil rights movement, abortion decisions by the Supreme Court, assassinations of presidents and political leaders like John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy, our politics remained middle of the road. Radio, TV, and newspapers, the three primary means of the media making money in this country in the 20th century, relied upon not antagonizing or alienating large segments of the population, but rather appealing to everyone. The national discourse and media was sober and without flair. Then came the internet, and everything changed. Because while 20th century media was about uniting a divided country under a national popular culture, 21st century media, at least so far, is primarily about balkanizing our country. The reason for that is simple. Massive audiences are declining due to the myriad of entertainment options. Major sporting events are one of the few national apolitical connective tissues we have left in this country. Unfortunately, in our modern era, even award shows have turned political, thanks to the desire of artists to advocate for political causes like never before. The result? In 2018, both Grammy and Oscar ratings plunged by over 20%. While sports fans have continued to produce massive audiences, that's become an outlier. Even popular sitcom shows in 2018 aren't that popular. The Cosby Show had a 41.3 rating at its apex and brought in tens of millions of viewers for every episode. Modern Family, in many ways the contemporary version of The Cosby Show, averaged a 2.3 rating with 7 million viewers in 2017. Pop culture, apart from comic book hero movies and other big-budget Hollywood releases, and an occasional show that breaks through like Game of Thrones or The Walking Dead, has become sort of pop culture. We all have so many entertainment options now that our interests are spread across the entertainment spectrum. Mad Men received tens of thousands of words in media coverage in the New York Times during its run on AMC, yet the show averaged only a couple of million viewers. One of my favorite shows, The Americans, on FX, had an audience of only 700,000 viewers on its live finale in 2018. That's less people than live in North Dakota. Depth of passion replaced depth of viewership as the coin of the media realm. The more passionate your audience, even if it was tiny, the more money you could make. Initially, ESPN was the beneficiary of this disaggregation, which led to the rise of cable networks. ESPN, by focusing on the targeted niche of sports fans, created the most valuable business in the history of media. Of course, this disaggregation didn't stop with cable, which could still provide substantial audiences in the case of live sports. It moved to the internet too. But And this is incredibly key. Sports, even as the rest of the world was rapidly changing, still retained the ability to unite us all. Why? Because sports weren't political. In a time and era when everything in the media is about turning us into tribal communities warring with each other in politics, sports stood against the tide, offering an opportunity to unite us. Our local tribes, Ohio State versus Michigan, Alabama versus Auburn, Duke versus North Carolina, Yankees versus Red Sox, meant more to us than our political tribes. And we knew how to put our jerseys back in the dresser when the game was over. Put it this way. Have you ever been celebrating a big win by your favorite team and thought anything about the political beliefs of the person you're high-fiving? Of course not. Sports unite us. They don't divide us. The new internet media environment, aided by the rise of social media through Twitter and Facebook, wasn't about having to satisfy every single person. It was only about having to satisfy a small segment of the overall population. You could build a business off appealing to a sliver of the population. That's because the internet let loose a new business dynamic when it came to media, giving you exactly what you wanted at the moment that you wanted it. The benefits have been incredible for the average media consumer, unleashing a tidal wave of pop culture creativity the likes of which we have never seen before in the history of the world. Interestingly, that same TV creativity has made our movies pale in comparison. Ask your average person who leaves a two-hour movie whether they would rather have seen the movie they just watched or watch two episodes of their favorite TV show. Chances are most people would pick their favorite TV show. These shows have even become so popular that many of you reading this right now would probably agree that which shows you favor tells us something about you. That is, we all feel so deeply connected to our favorite TV shows that they reveal something about ourselves to others. But, and this is key, the audiences for all these shows are not very substantial compared to the audiences that pop culture used to produce. Right now, if you're around my age, you probably watch Saved by the Bell, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and Growing Pains. We all, pretty much, watched the same shows in the 1980s and early 1990s. That's no longer the case. We've unleashed a great deal of creativity when it comes to modern media in the 21st century, but we've given up the shared experience of the 20th century. We've all become our own media islands. Chances are your tribe, the people in your neighborhood or school or community, are all watching the same shows, but the people different from you aren't watching the same shows anymore. That might well be fine when it comes to modern movies and TV, but it's been disastrous for our politics, which leaves us with a big question. If the internet and social media have been incredibly beneficial to popular culture when it comes to providing a wide variety of entertainment options, that is, the wealth of choices has never been better for viewers, and the quality of shows has never been better either, why has our national discourse on politics collapsed at the same time? Especially when you consider, again, that the divisive issues we're debating right now in this country pale in comparison to the issues that have divided us throughout our national history. Regardless of your politics, I think everyone reading this book would have to agree that whether or not slavery should be legal in the country is a bigger battle than which public bathrooms transgender people use. So why are we here? Because there's a business in dividing us through political media now, and sports is getting drawn into that national balkanization. Think back to my review of American media history. Newspapers, radio, and TV all relied upon massive audiences throughout the 20th century. Their business models were based upon appealing to everyone. Everyone had to like what you made, or at least not hate it. The result was a very middle-of-the-road, generally inoffensive set of articles, broadcasts, and shows. The same was true of our sports coverage. Then social media arrived, and I think big media companies lost their way in figuring out how to respond to it. It's not a coincidence that the Republicans and the Democrats both picked the most hated candidates in the history of our country to represent their parties, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Instead of sharing things that we love on social media, many of us have decided to make decisions that anger others. It used to be the country picked political candidates with a desire to convince others to support those candidates. That was a very 20th century way of selecting leaders. Pick the candidate that everyone would like. Now political parties don't do that. They pick the candidate that most outrages the other side. Our tribes are perpetually at war with one another. Sports didn't need to be like politics. Unlike television, where every television show is competing with another television show, there's only one NFL, and one NBA, and one NHL, and one Major League Baseball. There are only a few top college conferences. Sports already appealed to all of us. We didn't need sports to turn into politics. It was fine just as it existed. The problem was ESPN's collapsing business model left the network flailing. It had no idea how to respond to social media. So ESPN chose to overinflate the significance the company placed on it, leading to sports becoming just like politics. When it should have ignored the tribalization on social media and focused on being the uniting force in our country, ESPN and other sports companies that followed its lead instead looked for salvation online, but instead found damnation. The more time I spend on social media, the more I've come to believe that instead of leading us into a new media age, it's taking us back to one that existed in the early days of our republic when everything was tribal. What's particularly interesting about ESPN's decision to allow social media to change the way it covered sports is that early in the rise of Twitter, ESPN and I were on opposite sides of the social media revolution. In the winter of 2012, I stood outside an ESPN party in Miami before the Notre Dame-Alabama BCS title game, speaking with several of their top executives about the rise of Twitter. By 2012, I'd published two books, had a successful local Nashville radio show, and my website, Outkick the Coverage, was beginning to thrive. I'd figured out how to use social media as a promotional vehicle for the content I was creating on my site, and I was very active on Twitter. ESPN was not yet MSESPN. In fact, they were assiduously focused on remaining blandly inoffensive and ensuring that they stuck to sports. The most common social media minefield the company faced in 2012 was the question of what to do about jokes in Bill Simmons' ESPN columns. It seems quaint now, but the biggest controversy at ESPN back then was whether Bill Simmons could make fun of the WNBA or not. And that was big, controversial news. ESPN's goal, likely deriving from the Rush Limbaugh contretemps in 2003, was to run from any and all controversy. While this book takes several shots at ESPN, it's important to note that I have many friends who work at the company as both talent and executives, and that far from being contentious, for many years ESPN and I got along well. Indeed, as recently as 2015, the network tried to hire me to come work for them. Back then, we hadn't yet reached the fall of 2017 when one of the top ESPN PR executives would tweet that I'd said the word boobs 53 times on my radio show in an effort to get me fired. Seriously, ESPN put its PR team to work to see how many times I said the word boobs on my radio show. This was incredible for me to picture, just some guy in a conference room with a notepad in front of him, listening to all 3 hours of a rival radio network's programming and making a notch every time I said boobs. And then tweeting out those numbers as if that was going to make me look bad? Remember when I said I was smarter than all the people in sports PR? Yeah, I'm smarter than all the people in sports PR. To be fair, so are most of you reading this book. Back in 2012, those were happier times in our relationship. That day at the ESPN party on South Beach, we were debating social media and its impact on ESPN's television programming. In particular, we were discussing the disconnect between how Lou Holtz, the former Notre Dame and South Carolina coach and current college football analyst, and legendary ESPN employee Chris Berman, the man who I'd been thrilled to meet as a child, were received in public versus how they were received on social media. In public, these guys were mobbed, and people loved them. But on Twitter, they got crushed all the time, and most fans claimed to hate them. Not surprisingly, neither Holtz nor Berman were active on Twitter. Indeed, Berman, the most famous ESPN employee of all time, still does not have a Twitter account. Back in 2012, the ESPN executives were asking me a great question. Do you consider the real-life responses, or the Twitter responses, to these men and how you value Holtz and Berman on air at ESPN? At that point in time, the ESPN executives were arguing they needed to take into account the real-life response instead of the online response, because they felt it was more valid. I was arguing the online response should be their litmus test and was probably more honest. Since that time, I think we both flipped on our opinions. ESPN has chosen to let social media be their guide, and I've learned to value real life. This is partially because of how much Twitter has changed. 10 times more people use it now, and that has lowered the quality of the average user and the average content. Nowadays, it's fine to use Twitter and social media to get your message out, but worrying about Twitter opinions is the equivalent of obsessing because you look too fat in front of a Carnival Funhouse mirror. I've never had someone say a mean thing to me in person, despite a public career on sports radio, TV, and social media. Yet just about every single day on Twitter, people say if they ever see me in person, they're going to punch me. What happens when those people see me? They end up asking for a picture. That's because Twitter and social media in general isn't real. Everyone on Twitter acts like a WWE wrestler handed the mic at SmackDown or Raw. They hurl invectives, posture, feign outrage or threaten violence haphazardly, and generally posture for public acclaim and attention. But in real life, they meekly ask for a photo and say how much of a fan they are. I've learned this reality now, but in 2012, I was still of the opinion that Twitter was real life. It used to be Twitter was where I went to escape real life. Now real life is where I go to escape Twitter. My Twitter obsession was ridiculed by former FS1 president Jamie Horowitz when he told me reading your mentions was pathetic if you were on TV. Horowitz said I spent too much time on social media, not just me, but everyone like me in sports media, and he said he thought it was dumb. Why do you read your mentions, he asked. You don't walk up to strange people on the street all day asking them what they think of you, so why would you care what strange people online think of you on Twitter? You're the person with the opinion. You're the talent. People talk about their opinions of you and your opinions to other people. You don't talk with them about their opinion of you. His theory was that Twitter should be a megaphone. Use it to amplify your voice, but don't use it to care what anyone else thinks about your opinion. In many respects, I think this is the right way to think about Twitter in the modern era, but it's still a rare opinion. The overvaluation of Twitter opinions is even more the case when you consider that we now know social media is being constantly manipulated by bots, fake accounts, and foreign countries to inspire angst and weaken powerful institutions. We shouldn't be paying attention to social media reactions, but the ability for people in media to receive constant and immediate feedback is intoxicating. Find me a show where the on-air talent don't finish taping and immediately all rush to their phones to see what people are saying about them, and I'll find you a show filled with liars. Twitter, to the media, is our pond, and we're all narcissists, unable to look away from our own reflection. Immediate feedback is seductive and exhilarating, particularly in the media industry where everyone is, at least to some degree, a narcissist. But it's not just the sports media members who are obsessed with social media reaction. It's also their bosses who have stopped trusting their own gut instincts and become obsessed with what social media thinks of talent, stories, or their sports coverage in general. This obsession with reactions and opinions isn't new. People in positions of power have always been terrified of the people that put them in that position of power. I'm sure Roman leaders monitored the street graffiti written about them on ancient walls as a clue to how the populace was responding to their leadership. As our media has evolved from newspapers to radio to television to the internet to now instantaneous reaction on social media, it's all too common to find yourself falling into the pond while staring at your own reflection. Back ages ago, in 2007 or so, college administrators used to spend oodles of time trying to figure out whether sports fan message boards, which they monitored obsessively while claiming they paid no attention to them at all, accurately reflected the overall mindset of a fan base. I can't tell you the number of times I talked to college administrators who would ask me that question. What are the fans thinking? Are message boards or comments online to articles reflective of actual opinions? The answer is no. They aren't reflective of most public opinion. Message boards, like social media, are a stage and everyone is doing whatever they can to draw attention to themselves. This means strong opinions, pro or con, dominate. The best story I've heard about the false dynamic of message boards came from my buddy Chris Vernon, who talked about how when he first started doing local Memphis radio, he went on a Memphis Tiger message board to see what people were saying about his radio show. There was an entire thread that day discussing how Vernon had the worst show in the history of radio. He's actually very good at radio, but the story is reflective of what many people in media deal with. We all get crushed by anonymous people online, no matter how good we are at our jobs. Vernon read that thread and future threads about how bad he was on the message board and eventually decided to go to an event where all the guys on the message board met up in person. At the meetup, the message board crew, previously anonymous under their screen names, all walked around with their screen names on name tags on their shirts. What happened? He recognized many of the guys from their screen names. The same exact guys who had ripped him online came up to him and said how much they loved the show. Turns out their online opinions were entirely different from their face-to-face opinions. I found that to be true everywhere. Running your life by reacting to what Twitter thinks would be like eating donuts for every meal. Eventually you get fat and die an untimely death. The same thing has happened to ESPN. They tried to run a company based on social media junk food. Now they're dying because, ironically, they'd come to believe that social media was their savior, when in reality it was a false siren dragging them to a watery grave. 5 years after our Miami conversation before the Alabama and Notre Dame BCS title game, Lou Holtz and Chris Berman were both gone from ESPN, replaced on air by younger, hipper, and more plugged-in social media talent. ESPN replaced the old white guys who never shared their political opinions with left-wing social justice warriors who were more political on Twitter. Their rationale? ESPN was trying to reflect America. Which America were they reflecting? Not the America actually watching their games. They were trying to reflect the America they saw on social media. Why were they making this decision? I think it was rooted to a great degree in insecurity. By 2017, I was secure in my career, that what I was doing was working, and that I had a better idea what my audience wanted than anonymous people on social media did. ESPN was no longer secure in their business. Their ratings were tanking, and their subscribers were abandoning them by the millions. They were looking for a life vest to save them from drowning in social media, and instead, they found a heavy rock. Twitter is not and has never been real life or an accurate reflection of real life. It's a funhouse mirror that artificially reflects reality. Desperate to be loved as its business began to crumble, ESPN made the calculated decision to allow Twitter to become their primary sounding board of what sports fans wanted. As multiple stories online made clear every day, ESPN executives and programmers began scanning trending topics to see how fans were reacting online. How do we know this? Because ESPN allowed journalists at Yahoo and Forbes access to their planning meetings. Where were their ideas coming from? All of them were coming from social media. That's dangerous because Twitter is an angry and reactionary medium, the hottest of hot takes, frequently dished out without regard for facts at all. The hottest of the hot takes wrapped sports and politics together in perpetual righteous indignation. Everything in the world of Twitter is political. But that wasn't what ESPN's core audience wanted. Listening to Twitter backfired in a big way. Social media isn't saving companies like ESPN, it's killing them. And it's not just killing ESPN and sports media either. Social media and the resulting mainstream media coverage of social media has killed stand-up comedy too. Everyone's perpetually offended by jokes, but only offended enough to tweet about them. How often do you see someone protesting outside an actual comedy club? Almost never, right? And if you did see someone standing outside a comedy club with a sign protesting a joke that had been said inside the comedy club, you'd probably roll your eyes and mutter something about how that person needed to get a life, right? Yet, to be fair, that protester would be pretty committed to their perspective. They would have taken the time to get a poster board, write out a message, procure transportation to the sidewalk outside the club, and then stand outside on the street corner in the sun, the snow, the sleet, or the rain to make sure you saw their opinion. And you know what 99.9% of us would think when we drove by? Man, that person is a f***ing loser. If you don't like a comedian's jokes, don't go see him perform. That's your right as a consumer. But only a total loser would stand outside a comedy club and protest. Furthermore, the vast majority of the time, the media wouldn't bother to cover this protest either. At least I've never seen the media cover a protest outside a comedy club as breaking news. However, if that same person retweets a complaint about a comedian's joke while sitting on the couch in their underwear, something that literally takes 4 seconds to do and doesn't even require pants, it turns into an immediate story. That protester is taken seriously, even though that person has put in no effort at all to advance their point of view. But reporters at so many media outlets now are 26-year-olds writing 7 or 8 pieces a day. Who has time to get off Twitter and go to an actual protest? Reporters don't even have to leave their desk to turn Twitter outrage into a daily article or series of articles. If we'd be ridiculing the person who is physically protesting a joke outside a comedy store, shouldn't we all